Start our discussion of the West today, the settling of the West, the great Western frontier. And I have to admit, I love this image. I grew up in South Dakota, right? So I grew up around a lot of this kind of empty vastness. This is an image actually from the western part of the state. And it's kind of, you know, like this feeling of the endless sky and whatever, you know, all the romance about the West, right? but when I was growing up, I couldn't stand it. My dad would be all excited telling me stories about, you know, this cowboy or the stagecoach or the shootout. You're like, whatever. You know, I never, ever for the life of me could figure out why Deadwood was such a big deal, why people would come to those old towns and or Wall Drug. Like, why are people here? It's the most boring place on the planet, you know. And since I've gotten older, and I moved out of South Dakota when I was like 14 or 15, so you get an appreciation for a place once you're gone. I mean, you guys grew up in Louisiana where there's actual cool stuff happening, right? Like you can maybe understand why people get excited about, I don't know, various Louisiana traditions or food down here. There's lots to celebrate down here. Up there, not so much. Like vast amounts of really, yeah, it's pretty in a picture, but. but what do you guys think of when you think of the West?
Cowboy.
Like this guy. What do you think about with the cowboy? Who is he? What does he do? Why is he a cultural icon?
Buffalo.
What about the buffalo?
Hunting buffalo.
Hunting buffalo?
Yeah.
The worst smelling mammal on the face of the planet, just saying.
Best meat, though, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh, it's delicious. But, you know, the cowboy is like this international, universal symbol of what? What does he represent to you?
America.
America. What else? Why is he so American? Why can there not be like a Russian cowboy, or
John Wayne was American?
I'm sorry, say again.
John Wayne was American.
John Wayne. John Wayne was an American.
Because they had to ride horses to settle the West.
Okay.
Take law into their own hands.
Exactly. Take law into their own hands, ride around on these beasts, claim land, keep land safe. A few years ago, and adding to this kind of WTF moment I've always had about the Dakotas, there was a show on HBO called Deadwood. Right? Have any of you seen it? A lot of gratuitous violence, a lot of... you know, Wild West. Deadwood is a town in northwestern South Dakota, and it was an old mining town. And again, I could never understood why people went there. It's like, you know, all the old storefronts, and we'll talk a little bit more about that when we talk about mining. But this show, it was a series that was actually kind of interesting. It opens up, and there's a guy in a jail. And he's obviously in big trouble, and the sheriff comes over to him, you know, and he leans over to talk to the sheriff through the bars, and he says, "You can't keep me here because there's no law in Deadwood." Rah. You know, and this idea that it's lawless, yeah, it's huge, huge amounts of land, and where are the police, right? It might be federal United States land. It might fall under federal law. And, right, who's there? No one's there. Can't make me do anything. Can't make me do anything. So I think that kind of sense of lawlessness but yet protecting the land is somehow sexy, right? Somehow riveting. We have the Marlboro Man, right, who, of course, dies of cancer. You know this. Marlboro Man's a cowboy. Anything else about his character that you want to comment on? Anything that makes him internationally this hero of the West? Anything you can think of? Well, since we're talking about the hurricane or whatever right before class, the idea of self-sufficiency. He does this all by himself, right? Can cook for himself and take care of himself, take care of all sorts of things by himself, right? And the self-made man is definitely a part of the American kind of psychology or the myth of America, especially by the year like 1905 when Teddy Roosevelt introduces the Rough Riders, modeled after this kind of cowboy-esque lifestyle, right? You know, the attire was very similar for the Rough Riders and all of that. There's this image. What do you see here? This is from 1875.
Industrializing America.
Okay.
Pioneers being Native Americans.
Okay. What's the general mood of this art piece?
It's happiness.
Happiness.
Yeah, but like there must be at peace with the Indians.
Everyone's happy, right? And peaceful. So when you look at a piece of art like this, there's always three main parts, right? There's the foreground, the middle ground, and the background. And the foreground is usually the action that the artist wants to emphasize the most, but there's always other stuff going on. You also want to look at scale, like are things bigger or smaller? Some artists draw Indians, for example, to be teeny tiny and cavalrymen to be huge. If you look at portraits of George Washington, for example, oftentimes, if you were to measure him out versus the horse he's riding, oftentimes he'd be 9 feet tall, right? Because we know George Washington has that kind of myth with him. And in this, what's going on with foreground, middle ground, background, scale, all of these things? What is the artist trying to tell you through this technique?
Yeah, travelers, but like wagon, so it might be a wagon train.
Okay.
And the first railroad is coming across.
So in the middle ground, the core of this, the idea is people are coming, right? And they're coming in these covered wagons, also part of the romance, right? You pack up your family in a covered wagon, you'd have all your stuff there, have a big adventure, and then you'd settle somewhere. And then we have these wagons, these carts that are pulling, looks like lumber, maybe, building supplies.
Probably for railroad.
And then on the railroad, the cars are pulling houses. Like, you can't build houses fast enough, right? People are coming, and they're coming to live. But what? Tell me about this in the foreground. What specifically is happening here?
Americans and Native Americans,
like,
they're walking together.
Yeah, when they're hanging out by the fire,
yeah.
Right? And who are these Americans, though, specifically?
Soldiers.
And look, they're so totally hanging out that this guy has his rifle down, right? They're all just kind of using their rifles to as props as they're kind of leaning into them.
Did they give the Indians
life? Yes, they did. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sorry, I got a little bit distracted by the noise in the hallway. Yeah, absolutely. The soldiers or Americans in general would trade goods, and they would give rifles in exchange for food or in exchange for other things. So absolutely. So very cool. What's going on in the background?
Like Indian villages.
Yep. Lots of teepees. And again, the sense of harmony, because in the middle we have another covered wagon, right? And that's definitely... definitely not a Native American thing. So we have the ideal, right? Look at how peaceful the West is. And this is this is 1874, and this is reinforced about 20 years later in this image, in which the artist, this is called Manifest Destiny, picks up on the old idea of Manifest Destiny from 1824. Manifest Destiny is a term that was coined by John O'Sullivan, who was a journalist in San Francisco. And O'Sullivan believed Manifest Destiny was our moral obligation as Americans to populate the North American continent from coast to coast and spread Christianity, institute our democracy, and so on and so forth, right? So this is an artist's interpretation of that. And clearly, it's after 1824 because Lady Liberty is stringing telephone wire or some type of electrical wire, right, throughout the land. But we still have a lot of the same elements as the image from 1874. So we have the covered wagon, we have a stagecoach, we have Indians over on the far left, all peacefully kind of coexisting together, right? So this is to say, a lot of times when we think about settling the West, we think of cowboys and Indians, right? We think that there's these fights between cowboys and Indians, and clearly there's a whole movie genre dedicated to those kinds of shootouts, right? And I need to emphasize, of course, those are few and far between. They do happen. Those skirmishes do happen. It's not a daily occurrence for a lot of places. Also, if you look up Indian history during this time, there are some websites that announce that the removal of Indians from the West is a genocide. Have you ever heard that theory before? That is to say, I caution, if you run across a website that says Hitler planned his genocide based on what happened to the Native Americans, I caution you, a genocide literally, legally, means a state-sponsored program to exterminate a group or an ethnic or a race, right? But it has to come from a government. And technically, minor technicalities, we can say that federal government policy was not the extinction of Native Americans. It was removal, it was containment, or it was assimilation. We'll get into those policies in just a second. But if you see, you know, if you're interested in looking up stuff after today's lecture, please do it. And you can, you know, send me the links. I'll post them up on Blackboard if you find something really interesting. But take it all with a grain of salt, but it is brutal. That's to say, it is brutal. And federal Indian policy forces us to ask three main questions. The first was, what were the main objectives of federal Indian policy in the late 1800s? Because there is a distinct policy. When we come into the scene and we're still kind of straddling this pre-Civil War and post-Civil War world, one of the aspects of federal Indian policy that we are kind of done with is the policy of removal. That during the early 1800s, Indians were forced to march west of the Mississippi to make sure that the eastern half of the U.S. was safe for civilization. And by the 1840s, that program is largely complete. But that's the first step in these federal programs. The second question then is, let's say once these Indian tribes are moved against their will, then west of the Mississippi, why would they ever surrender their land to the federal government? Right? What impetus is behind the surrender of land and ceding it then in perpetuity to the U.S. government? And lastly, we're going to be looking at specifically the Plains Indians and what caused the Plains Indians ultimately to surrender to the federal government. In other words, cede not only land, but control and right to certain areas and to...
That was because they have a conflict among each other?
They do and they don't, and I'll get into that in just a second. But these, for today then, in other words, we're going to be talking about Native Americans and federal policy vis-a-vis Native Americans in the settling of the West. All right? Any questions? Excellent. So, quick overview. When the English first come, the United States looks like this. The known United States, up until about the year 1800 settlement, is shaded in green. By the year 1800, it's the light green color. So we don't really have a ton of movement westward by the year 1800. Kentucky is about as far west as we go. When we get to 1850, still before the Civil War, we see all areas east of the Mississippi are fairly well settled, save for the areas very far up north that were still kind of unchartered territory. And of course, then we do have these pockets in California and in New Mexico. What would cause people to move out to California and New Mexico?
Gold.
Awesome. 1848, massive gold rush in California. And we know that along the way, people settled in New Mexico also for similar reasons. And of course, gold exploration continues. So after 1850 and up until 1890, this is then the pattern of American movement or settlement in the United States. And here on this map, we can see there's more development up north and pretty much kind of, well, patchy, but solidly throughout the western portion of the United States as well. So, of course, as we know, whenever we talk about this kind of demographic movement, we have to give nod to the people who were there first, who's being displaced, because it's never a story of kind of assuming people into a population. It's always displacement of who was there first. And originally, this is kind of a map of the U.S. that we would have encountered probably up until the time right before the Civil War. And it's more of a cultural map because, remember, the Indians tended to be nomadic, migratory. They would have treaties and agreements, very sophisticated ones, with other tribes or with other clans as to who could be on this part of the river during this season and so on and so forth. And the English could never figure out how those treaties worked, who officiated them. They never understood why these people don't have fences, right? Why there's no claim to private property, this type of stuff. But it breaks down into cultural zones, which is also kind of largely representative of linguistic zones as well. But for example, in the Northeast, there are the Algonquian and the Iroquois tribes that might speak the same language, but they don't necessarily always get along, right? In the Southeast, we have like the Chippewa, for example, or the Cherokee. The Plains Indians, as you can tell, that's a huge swath of land. And these are tribes that included as Plains Indians that might not speak the same language, might not share a lot of the same traditions. And so culturally, these associations are really too broad, right? Any questions on these? Okay, fair enough. Today we're going to be focusing specifically on three areas. The first is the Sioux Indians, the Blackfeet, and then the Kiowa. And in each of these areas, there is resistance and or attack on territory and on person that causes land and the idea of ownership to be altered somehow, either permanently or temporarily. These three tribes are, for example, I'm sorry, these two tribes, like the Sioux and the Kiowa, would be considered to be part of the Plains Indian group. But you can see the diversity if you think of like southern Minnesota or central South Dakota right now versus the landscape and the climate of North Texas. They're very different, right? So you can see why I'm, you know, just cautioning you that there's lots of different groups and lots of diversity amongst them. That is to say, the Native Americans met with three discrete sets of policies. As I already mentioned, there was a policy of removal, which was largely completed by the time the Civil War begins in the 1840s. Shortly after that, there is what's called the policy of concentration. And this map kind of crystallizes the end of removal and the beginning of concentration. And what do you notice about the pattern of the green arrows on this map? Almost all go to Oklahoma, right? And this, for example, is the famous Trail of Tears, this line that the Cherokee were forced to march, and they settle in Oklahoma, was now Oklahoma. We have some kind of random patterns that happen during the period we're going to be looking at today. Finally, once kind of this reorganization is done by 1894, we have the adoption of what's called the policy of assimilation. What does it mean to assimilate? What is assimilation?
Take people, put them into your culture.
Exactly. You take someone from outside your culture and you make them the same as your culture. The motto is kill the Indian, save the man. What does that say to you? Exactly. That the human is worth saving, but the culture, savage. Can't have that in civilized society. And in fact, that's the language. It's still this kind of early modern idea of savage, barbarian life versus civilized life. And we see these words crop up over and over and over again. So again, we're going to be looking at the Sioux, the Blackfoot, and the Kiowa. And again, these are the regions. These regions, notice, are moderately affected by the policy of removal, except for the two northernmost regions. Any questions or comments so far? Fair enough. So again, we can't really move forward with understanding what happens until we understand what can happen. There are sets of laws, there are sets of treaties that are supposed to govern and regulate behavior. So I'm going to run through these three quickly, and then we'll look at some examples then of how they are applicable or not applicable. The first is the Nez Perce Treaty of 1863, which was kind of a shambles of a treaty. It was signed illegally on behalf of the Nez Perce because not all members of the Nez Perce tribe were present to accept the terms of the treaty. Right? Within a tribe, you have several clans, and not all of the clans were represented, and therefore it made the entire document untenable. But nevertheless, the Nez Perce apparently agreed to abandon 6 million acres of land in return for a small reservation in northeastern Oregon. This led to a series of wars that were kind of inter-clan wars, and that might be what you were referring to earlier, that there's tension between the groups. And that's definitely, this is a great example of something that causes tension. The wars end in 1877 at the end of Reconstruction with the surrender of Chief Joseph. Yes, ma'am?
It was agreed to abandon how many acres?
6 million acres. Yeah, it's a lot of land. So you can see why some clans members might have been like, no thank you. I always think that the Nez Perce Treaty is kind of interesting, though, because it has the same lifespan as the Reconstruction, right? The Proclamation of Amnesty and Reconstruction is signed in 1863, and Reconstruction is largely over by 1877. So it's, you know, happening at the same time as another major project in the U.S. That's to say also, remember that in terms of enforcing a lot of these treaties, it's hard. The U.S. is still recovering from the Civil War. It doesn't necessarily have the manpower or the money to go out and make sure that everything is running perfectly. And to that end, there's another kind of dire treaty that's supposed to be recognized as the treaty between the Native Americans and the federal government. That's the Medicine Lodge Treaty of 1867. 2 years after the end of the Civil War. And this is supposed to assign the first set of reservations. So this would be the first policy that we have to develop the reservation system. And it includes hundreds of tribes, including the Comanches, the Plains, or the Kiowa Indians in North Texas that we just saw, the Apaches, the Cheyennes, the Arapahoes, together with the Sioux of the North, the Shoshone, who live around kind of the area of Montana, Idaho, the Bannocks, all the way down to the Navajos in New Mexico. So not only is that a huge reservation system just geographically, but the amount of people it's supposed to be shuttling into tracts of land is kind of unthinkable. It's not a very good treaty, right? There's lots of loopholes in it that the federal government can't really sustain after a while either. They can't really claim, well, listen, you've given us this land, and we promise that you can have this land. It kind of falls apart by about the 1870s. The one treaty out of all of these that's thought to be the strongest is the Treaty of Fort Laramie. Fort Laramie is in Wyoming. It's also known as the Sioux Treaty of 1868. And this was thought to be successful because it brought peace to Red Cloud's War, a long, long, long battle. And in that peace, the Sioux were granted huge tracts of land, the whole western part of South Dakota. So everything to the west of the Mississippi River in South Dakota, the Sioux got, including the Badlands, including access to various waterways. And the Sioux were also granted permanent rights to the Powder River country in Wyoming and Montana. The Powder River, again, is a very important waterway that's now great for trout fishing, if you ever are interested. But in any event, the Sioux Treaty is thought to be successful because it's supposed to very clearly delineate who gets what land Also, it evacuates federal troops immediately upon signing from those tracts of land that it cedes to the Sioux, or that it grants to the Sioux. Does that make sense? So theoretically, everybody walks away happy. Anyone have questions? Still getting that look like, yeah, yeah, go on. It translates very literally into this map. That, again, it's a map of the western half of the United States, and this kind of dark gray represents land that was ceded to the federal government between 1865 and 1894, and the gold color are the Indian reservations that were developed then during this policy of containment. What do you see with the gray or the gold, or what do you see patterns? Do you not see patterns? That's good points. Yeah, so huge amounts of land, right? Huge amounts of land are officially, they're signed over to the federal government. And we have then this displacement, those green arrows that we saw shuttling various tribes into the reservations, which are pretty dinky for the most part. I mean, Oklahoma as a state, right, has the most, and then we have Arizona Territory with the Navajo reservations, and then South Dakota with the Sioux reservations as kind of being the largest continuous tracts. They're not necessarily geographically the most awesome. It, of course, increases competition for space, for hunting, for everything when you force people to live in closer quarters than what they're used to. Again, we're going to be focusing then more on a story than the Blackfeet, who experienced what's called, often is referred to as the Sand Creek Massacre. Sometimes it's referred to as the Marias Massacre of 1864. The Kiowa, who were involved in the Red River War of 1874-1875, and the Sioux, who were involved in two major battles that then start to really define federal policy toward the Indian: Battle of Little Bighorn in 1876, as well as the massacre at Wounded Knee in 1891, which is kind of the end of these bigger conflicts between U.S. military and Native Americans. So these are the regions that I'm always interested in. Granted, this map has a lot of other little red stars, right, that show areas of other conflicts. And I think the text talks about different ones as well. These always are big standouts because, again, I see them as really pivotal for how federal policy begins to shift. That is to say, because these conflicts happen, it doesn't always dictate how land is going to be distributed. So, for example, after the Battle of Little Bighorn, we see that that falls into an area of land that's signed over to the federal government, right? Even though it's Custer's last stand, and technically the U.S. lost that. They got that land. However, the massacre at Wounded Knee is still part of the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. So it's definitely, it's not a foregone conclusion if one side or the other wins a battle. But these battles take place. And again, we see that there are a lot of other little battles that go on, especially in the Dakotas and Montana and along the Powder River right here. And again, if you're interested, definitely look into them. They're all pretty fascinating. Any questions so far? Okay. So we're going to start out with what's called the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864. Again, sometimes referred to as the Marias River Massacre or the Marias Massacre. 1864 is before the official end of the Civil War. So that there is military here patrolling is something that's noteworthy that we should at least pay attention to. This is an area where the Blackfeet live, and the Blackfeet Confederacy was not at war with any group. And in fact, they had signed a series of peace treaties along with the Nez Perce in 1863. They could produce documents to show that they had in no way declared war. They had not enacted hostilities against whites who were in the area. But they were targeted by a colonel who was a former Methodist minister, a man by the name of J.M. Shivington. And he operated on a collective punishment theory, that because you remind me of someone that I don't like, and those people have done me wrong, I'm going to do something to you, right? Collective punishment, we know, not a very good thing. But he really believed that if you see a group of people that could cause you harm, better to get rid of them now than wait until they actually do cause you harm. And his famous phrase for defending his actions was, "Nits make lice." Have you heard that phrase? It's gross, I know. What does that mean? Nits make lice. What are nits? N-I-T-S.
Those little flies. No,
that's gnats.
What was that guy's name again?
Shivington, C-H-I-V-I-N-G-T-O-N, Shivington. Nits are lice eggs. And if they hatch, they make full-grown adult lice that reproduce and have more eggs, right? So he was very keen on eradicating Indians, kind of indiscriminate. He attacks this settlement, which was actually of the Black Kettle settlement within the Blackfeet tribe, and he is convinced, apparently, that he's in imminent danger. However, all of the men are out on a ritual hunt. So he attacks an encampment that has women, elderly, and children, and some sick young men, but not warrior men. It's estimated that he killed maybe around 200, 300 people. However, by his count, he killed about 700 people. And to be fair, there's a huge discrepancy, and this gets a little bit gruesome, but armies that would conduct these kind of massacres would burn the encampment after a massacre, and then they would bury the bodies in mass graves, making counting difficult, right? Counting charred corpses is not exactly the easiest thing. It's estimated that he mutilated about 150 people, and in fact was so proud of this that he carried trophies around with him in jars for a long, long time. He showed up at a theater in Denver, Colorado, and he had jars full of hands and ears, scalps, genitalia, and in one instance, a fetus. And he invited the public to come and see how he's taming the West, how he's making it civilized. And needless to say, people who came and looked and saw this were repulsed and appalled. And they thought to themselves, really, this is federal policy? You're acting as an American? Because that's un-American, right? Newspaper articles start to come out like, this guy is not American. He needs to be stopped. So lawyers are called, and he's deposed, and nothing ever really happens to him. But it's easy to see why many people feel that the official policy would be that type of brutality, because nothing ever really happens to him. And in this is a visual representation, then, of the Sand Creek Massacre by a member, of a neighboring tribe, a Cheyenne eyewitness by the name of Howling Wolf, who depicts a cavalry coming in against a line of people that eventually run out of ammo. And then they're pretty much defenseless, right? They're not on their horses. They're not charging. And this is another interpretation of a survivor of the Sand Creek Massacre. And again, we see that in the center, lots of bodies, possibly women, lots of smaller bodies, probably children, and then we see figures like this, which is what?
A baby
in a papoose, right? That kind of skeletal frame that you could strap to your body and walk around with. So this is General Shivington. And at the deposition in 1865, he's asked about 12 questions. And the 10th question is this: what reason had you for making the attack? What reasons, if any, had you to believe that Black Kettle or any other Indian or Indians in the camp entertained feelings of hostility toward the whites? give in detail the names of all Indians so believed to be hostile, with the dates and places of their hostile acts, so far as you may be able to do so. So, he's being asked to give specifics. Why did you attack? Specifically, what evidence did you have? Who and the what and the where and the when, right? So the deposer wants to know all this stuff. And this is what he responds. Does anybody want to read this? Go ahead.
I believe the Indians in the camp were hostile to the whites, that they were of the same tribes with those who had murdered many persons and destroyed much valuable property on the Platte. That's right.
Platte River.
Platte, mm-hmm. And Arkansas rivers during the previous spring, summer, and fall was beyond a doubt. When a tribe of Indians is at war with the whites, it is impossible to determine what party or band of tribe or the name of the Indian or Indians belonging to the tribe so at war are guilty of the acts of hostility.
Thank you. So he's asked for specifics, and what does he say? Can't tell them apart. Can't tell them apart, right? And what else? What else is he saying?
That when you're at war, you don't have time to really check, and see what tribe. You don't ask questions.
Chop the head off first and ask questions later. Did you want to add something?
No, I just hear you say that.
Well, and do you guys, do you know where the Platte River is or the Arkansas River?
Arkansas.
Well, and the Platte River runs through kind of southern-ish Nebraska. So it's kind of a far cry from areas north Idaho. And so again, it's possible that the Blackfeet could migrate all the way throughout these areas. It's not probable. It's not probable at all, especially in the time frame that he's suggesting, the previous spring, summer, and fall. So within 1 year that their migratory patterns would have been so diverse, it's not probable in the slightest. But the idea is he believes that Indians attack whites. It is impossible to determine who did what, and better safe than sorry, right? Impossible to determine what party... we're guilty of hostility. So this goes back to the idea again of collective punishment. Does that make sense? If the Sioux attack me, I may as well attack, I don't know, the Navajo. That makes no sense, right? Any questions? Excellent. We move on to a different war, and this one is actually instigated by Native Americans. This is the Red River War of 1874. This is in the area where the Kiowa tribe is. Again, there are many different groups that circulate in this region. But in any event, this is a very bloody conflict that lasts for many months. It is under the leadership of the kind of intrepid Apache warrior Geronimo. And it's a reclaiming of land, a reclaiming of space, kind of a refusal of going to Oklahoma territory. Remember, this is in the northern Texas panhandle, very close to Oklahoma. So in 1874, the army is called in and crisscrosses the panhandle, kind of indiscriminately attacking bands of Indians it believes has declared war for this reclaiming of the territory, whether they actually had been involved with this or not. Again, lots of different groups are involved. But in any event, the war winds down because fewer and fewer Indian bands have the strength to keep fighting. Most of the ammo is traded from whom? Where do they get the ammo?
From the white men.
Absolutely. A lot of times from soldiers. And soldiers aren't trading ammo for anything anymore. And so once you run out of ammo, your rifle is just kind of a pretty decorative item, right? So restocking and getting supplies to keep fighting is pretty, pretty impossible. So it's a battle that ends up very one-sided. And I guess we could say that the federal army wins again, right? And here again we have this image of a chieftain on the upper right facing then this kind of trench of sorts that the Federal Army has built and is using, it looks, pretty effectively. In any event, there's this. Next up, we have the Battle of Little Bighorn, and I'm assuming most of you have heard of this, right? Custer's Last Stand. I know I'm from South Dakota. I know every year. Every year we got to listen to this, but who's Custer? What's the big deal about Custer's Last Stand? Because you shook your head yes. Okay.
He was an American general.
Mm-hmm.
He was killed in Battle of Little Bighorn, and he was slaughtered in
years. Yeah, he's a pretty stubborn guy also. He's pictured here at his last stand with two pistols. I don't know if you can see that. Pistol in each hand, shooting indiscriminately. This is the area of land that was supposed to, in 1868, be permanently given to the Sioux. We had that map up earlier. This is an area kind of by the Powder River where Sioux are supposed to have access. What might have changed to cause the Federal Army to want to reclaim the land?
Gold.
Gold, Black Hills gold, right? So there are some history books. I remember last year we were using a text that said Custer himself discovered the gold. I don't think that's accurate. I don't think he was very much of an explorer. But I think if the textbook is, and I've looked it up, I can't figure it out. So if you ever read that, Custer did not discover gold. But his troops defended the right to keep American gold, right, for the federal government. It's significant. Again, just because of the point being that the federal government gets this land, right? Even though it's treated to the Sioux after the Battle of Little Bighorn, it goes back to the federal government. It's ceded back to the federal government. And this could be because of a number of reasons. We know that Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse had to surrender after this battle, thereby relinquishing some kind of spiritual connection with the land. But that leads into my next issue, and that's the battle, the massacre at Wounded Knee. The Sioux were encouraged to continue to practice their cultural practices by other tribesmen. And this is important because part of the treaty ending the Battle of the Little Bighorn was that the Sioux would not practice, for example, the ghost dance, or they would not speak a native language in the presence of a white man. And the ghost dance, if you've never seen one before, if you have and you're watching it at night, it's a little different, right? Especially if you're a Christian soldier. There's these guys dressed up in skins, dancing around a fire, chanting, smoking, and the purpose of the ceremony is to call upon the ghost to bring peace, to call upon the ghost to bring good harvest, to call upon the host to bring cure to a disease, something along that line. But the ghost dance is something that I don't think the Sioux will ever stop, right? It's kind of like going to church on Sunday for some of us. It's something that's very much a part of the culture, very much expected part of your life as a member of the Sioux tribe. And in the late 1890s, early 1891, soldiers were writing to their generals saying, listen, we saw them doing this again. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? So over the course of the year of 1891, the army is given the blessing to go in and attack the Sioux who are practicing the ghost dance. And it culminates in the massacre at Wounded Knee, which kills about 200 Indians. And the battle happens, or the massacre, because it happens at night when everyone's sleeping. It happens in the dead of winter. And South Dakota is like frozen solid. About 200. Well, so they come back in April of 1891 once it starts to kind of thaw a little bit. They should have come back in June when it really is defrosted. But they came back then, and then this is an example of one of the mass graves that that the Federal Army would dig after a massacre to dispose of the bodies. Clearly, this is not in keeping with Sioux tradition either, but, you know, Who's to say? But again, this land eventually does get incorporated into the reservation system. So this is actually about all the time that I have for today. I see we're running out of time. Be sure to sign up for First Call so that you get emergency alerts vis-a-vis this potential hurricane. Any questions? All right. I will see you either Wednesday or Friday, and be safe. Thank you. Hey. Good.
I'm doing your class.
Welcome. I'm going to shut this off.